my title might seem to you odd, and you wouldn't be wrong to think it odd. After all, the question, can the separation of church and state be sustained, might seem to have been settled. Within some corners of the United States, church and state have been separate now for almost a quarter of a millennium. Within other quarters, they have been separate for nearly 200 years. Moreover, the purpose for their separation has been fulfilled. Catholics and Protestants are not murdering one another in the United States and really never have engaged much in that kind of conduct. And within Western Christendom, and even to some degree beyond, our success in this country has inspired imitation. Even in, say, England and Scotland, where tradition is honored and at least nominally there's an established church, throne and altar are no longer in any serious way entangled. I spent a year or two terms at All Souls College, and in the middle of my time there, a law was passed that you couldn't serve food and have smoking in the same room. And so, in consequence, the smoking room where they served coffee after dinner and so forth, you couldn't smoke in. But the college voted to keep calling it the smoking room. Very, very English. And so there's an established church in name only. Within Western Christendom, the decision to separate church and state was a response to a problem. Christianity is first and foremost a religion of faith. As a consequence, doctrinal differences have frequently given rise to schism, and where church and state were closely connected, schism gave rise to violence, domestic disorder, and even in the international sphere to war. In antiquity, before the conversion of Constantine, religious disputes within Christianity were by and large confined to the private sphere. After Constantine's conversion, as is evidenced by the Council of Nicaea, which was aimed at the Arian controversy, those disputes, which mainly in those days had to do with Christology, became a matter of public concern and a threat to political order. Everyone in this room knows about Catholics and Protestants versus one another at the time of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation. But there's an earlier history that looks very much like that history, arising from the Christological disputes in the early church. Indeed, had it not been for the persecution of monophysite Christians by the Orthodox emperors quartered in Constantinople, Egypt might still be Christian today. The monophysites welcomed the Muslims as liberators. It's that bad. The troubles of late antiquity were revisited on Western Christendom in the 16th and 17th centuries, when the disputes between Catholics and Protestants gave rise to civil wars within the Holy Roman Empire and France, and when disputes within Protestantism helped give rise to civil war within Great Britain. Early on, Erastianism seemed the only way out. Cynical though it might have been, cuius regio, eius religio was a formula that allowed for a cessation of hostilities, and Thomas Hobbes made a powerful, principled argument for its adoption. Even those who favored religious toleration, and Hobbes was in some measure cautiously in favor of religious toleration, tended to think that there should be an established church. David Hume is a case in point. He thought it vain to think that any free government will ever have security or stability in the absence of a dependence of the clergy on the civil magistrate, Caesaropapism. In his History of England, he argued that the interested diligence of the clergy is what every wise legislator will study to prevent, that zeal gives rise to superstition, folly, and delusion, and that each ghostly practitioner, in order to render himself more precious and sacred in the eyes of his retainers, will inspire them with the most violent abhorrence of all other sects. And then, he concluded, that the most decent and advantageous composition that the authorities could make with the spiritual guides is to bribe their indolence. That's his description of the Anglican Church, and from my experience in England, it works. by assigning stated salaries to their profession. In time, some came forward to suggest that religious establishment did more harm than good. In The Wealth of Nations, which was published in 1776 and widely read in North America in the years that followed, Hume's close friend, Adam Smith, did so to powerful effect. In his letter concerning toleration, John Locke had made the wry observation that where religious sects have not the power to carry on persecution and to become masters, there they desire to live upon fair terms and preach up toleration. Smith built on this observation. First, he quoted at length Hume's discussion of the theological political problem. He readily acknowledged that the interested and active zeal of religious teachers can be dangerous and troublesome, but he contended that this condition would obtain only where there is either but one sect tolerated in the society, or where the whole of a large society is divided into two or three great sects. That zeal, he says, must be altogether innocent, where the society is divided into 200 or 300 sects, or perhaps as many as 1,000 sects. Keep in mind, he comes from Scotland, where I believe there are 35 different Presbyterian sects, and they all hate one another, of which no one could be considerable enough to disturb the public tranquility. The virtue of all these small sects is none of them have any hope of taking over. So what do they want? Freedom of religion. You know, it's sort of Adam Smith's invisible hand. You do the right thing for the wrong reasons. The teachers of each sect, seeing themselves surrounded on all sides with more adversaries than friends, would be obliged to learn that candor and moderation, which is so seldom found among the teachers of those great sects, whose tenets being supported by the civil magistrate are held in veneration by almost all the inhabitants of extensive kingdoms and empires, and who therefore see nothing round them but followers, disciples, and humble admirers. The teachers of each little sect, finding themselves almost alone, would be obliged to respect those of almost every other sect, and the concessions which they would mutually find it both convenient and agreeable to make to one another might in time, he says, probably reduce the doctrine of the greater part of them to that pure and rational religion, free from every mixture of absurdity, imposture, or fanaticism, such as wise men have in all ages wished to see established. To support his argument, Smith pointed to Pennsylvania, where the establishment of full religious freedom had been productive of this philosophical good temper and moderation. Now, the celebrated author of The Theory of Moral Sentiments and The Wealth of Nations not only believed that the interested and active zeal of religious teachers would be altogether innocent in a society divided into a great multiplicity of sects, he was prepared to go one step further and assert that in such circumstances, the excessive zeal of the various and rival denominations would be productive of several good effects, even if equality of treatment should fail to instill philosophical good temper and moderation in all, or even in the greater part of the religious sects of a particular country. Smith prefaced his defense of zealotry with the observation that in civilized societies marked by distinctions of rank, two different schemes of morality tend to coexist. A liberal or loose system built on the vices that are apt to arise from great prosperity, and a strict or austere system that accords well with the needs of men short of means. Because nearly every new religious sect had originated among the common people, almost every sect preaches austerity. Many have even endeavored to gain credit by refining upon this austere system and by carrying it to some degree of folly and extravagance. And this excessive rigor has frequently recommended them more than anything else to the respect and veneration of the common people. The Scottish philosopher was willing to tolerate and even encourage a modicum of folly and extravagance because he believed it was a small price to pay for the good that would accompany it. Men of rank and fortune are always in the public eye, he observed. The liberal system of morality prevails in their sphere that prevails in their sphere may open the path to luxury, wanton, and even disorderly mirth, the pursuit of pleasure to some degree of intemperance, the breach of chastity in at least one of the two sexes, and so forth. But it does not produce gross indecency and lead to falsehood or injustice, because there are limits to what society as a whole will tolerate, and these men dare not do anything that would disgrace or discredit them in the eyes of their compatriots. At the very least, they will hide their vice. Men of low condition are in a different situation. They are similarly restrained only while they remain in country villages where their conduct attracts attention. In cities, the poor man is all too often sunk in obscurity and darkness. His conduct is observed and attended to by nobody. And he is therefore very likely to neglect it himself and to abandon himself to every sort of low profligacy and vice. Such a man can draw considerable profit from the interested and active zeal of religious teachers. For he never emerges so effectually from his obscurity, his conduct never excites so much the attention of any respectable society as by his becoming the member of a small religious sect. He from that moment acquires a degree of consideration which he never had before. All of his brothers are, for the credit of the sect, interested to observe his conduct. And if he gives occasion to any scandal, if he deviates very much from those austere morals which they almost always require of one another, they are ready to punish him by what is always a very severe punishment, even where no civil effects attend it: expulsion or excommunication from the sect. In little religious sects, accordingly, the morals of the common people have been almost always remarkably regular and orderly. Generally, much more so than in the established church, where you've bribed the indolence of the clergy. In short, in an extended republic, sectarianism and religious zealotry can serve as an antidote to the anonymity of urban life. Membership in a close-knit religious association provides individuals with a sense of place. Like citizenship in the ancient Greek polis, it brings the force of shame to bear in a fashion that encourages self-restraint, decency, and a spirit of self-sacrifice. Smith was well aware of the defects inherent in the ancient city, and he acknowledged that the morals of his little sects have frequently been rather disagreeably rigorous and unsocial. They don't even allow dancing. But in a commercial society blessed with religious diversity, especially if the state encourages the study of science and philosophy and gives entire liberty to all those who, for their own interest, would attempt without scandal or indecency to amuse and divert the people by painting, poetry, music, dancing, and by all sorts of dramatic representations and exhibitions, he thought that no one need fear a revival of the martial fervor which had gripped the republics of antiquity, or a return of the persecuting spirit which had made a slaughterhouse of Christendom. Now, look, James Madison had read both Locke and Smith. He'd observed in Pennsylvania the very things described by Adam Smith. And when he attempted in Virginia to get the state legislature to pass Thomas Jefferson's Statute of Religious Liberty, he discovered that high-minded arguments in favor of religious liberty were far less important than the fact that the Baptists and Methodists were growing and Presbyterians were growing in numbers, and that everybody feared that they might be on the wrong end of the stick when persecution came. So they united in disestablishment out of fear that when the establishment took place, it wouldn't be their establishment, it would be somebody else's establishment. He took that same argument and he applied it to economic interests. So if you look at Federalist number 10, it's the religious argument carried over. That is to say, the more complex the society is, the less likely there will be a majority faction. And the more likelihood that the petty interests will collude together in support of general freedom. In writing to Thomas Jefferson, he wrote, "The same security seems requisite for the civil as the religious rights of individuals. If the same sect form a majority and have the power, other sects will be sure to be depressed. Divide et impera, the reprobated axiom of tyranny, divide and conquer, is under certain qualifications the only policy by which a republic can be administered on just principles." Now, Smith's analysis had purchase on men who were dedicated, also had purchase on men who were dedicated to the establishment of a republic, who were convinced that republican government presupposes a considerable measure of virtue and self-discipline in the citizen body, and who were persuaded that urbanization is inevitable and urban life inherently corrupting. Thus, when Thomas Jefferson contended that difference of opinion is advantageous in religion, he justified his conclusion on the grounds that several sects perform the office of a censor morum over each other, a censor of morale, of morality. "Where there is no religious establishment," he remarked, "religion is well supported, of various kinds indeed, but all good enough, all sufficient to preserve peace and order." In his first inaugural address, he returned to the same theme and publicly celebrated the fact that his countrymen acknowledged and adored an overruling providence and were enlightened by a benign religion, professed indeed and practiced in various forms, yet all of them inculcating honesty, truth, temperance, gratitude, and the love of man. Like Adam Smith, he was of the view that good things came from zealous religion. Now, that might seem a surprise to you, because he certainly was not a believer himself. I go through all of this because the Pennsylvania celebrated by Adam Smith and the Virginia imagined by Madison and Jefferson was the America which I once knew. I'm 70 years old now, so I grew up in the last millennium. In Oklahoma and Colorado when I was a child, in New York and Connecticut when I was a college student, in Connecticut, New York, Pennsylvania, and Oklahoma, where I taught college, there was plenty of religious agitation, and there was a rivalry between the sects, as there still is at Hillsdale College, which is in a time warp, where I now teach. My wife has pointed out to me that when they hold a kind of fair for freshmen for various organizations, if you listen carefully, you will hear the word papist. And then you wander down the street and you hear the word heretic. those are wonderful words. This agitation was, for the most part, constrained by the requirements of civility. And the priests, ministers, and rabbis competed in preaching pretty much the same morality. A morality, let me add, of the very sort required by a pluralist civil society. I could go on, and I could argue that there's a connection between religious freedom on the one hand and limited government and political liberty on the other. Think of the First Amendment. "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." I would submit that James Madison knew what he was doing when he linked in this document the three participial phrases that define its scopes. I would submit that while barring religious establishments and protecting the free exercise of religion are theoretically distinct, they tend in practice to be unsustainable where both are not in place. I would suggest that political liberty tends to be meaningless where freedom of speech and the press and the right peaceably to assemble and petition the government for a redress of grievances is not guaranteed. And I would argue that only where there is disestablishment and a free exercise of religion can one hope in the long run to have those political rights safeguarded. In other words, it's not an accident that John Locke, who penned the letter concerning toleration, was also the man who, in his guise as a civil servant under William III, was responsible for England's quiet abandonment of the licensing of the press. In modern times, intellectual freedom, political freedom, and religious liberty have always been inseparable. There's another, perhaps better way to make the same point. Limited government is a modern phenomenon. It was crafted in the late 17th century to solve the otherwise apparently insuperable problem that I've already discussed, the catastrophic political consequences of the fact, as visible in late antiquity, especially in the Christian East, as it would be in the Christian West during and after the Reformation, that the Christian faith tends to give rise to doctrinal disputes and sectarian divisions. Only if these can somehow be quarantined, John Locke and others thought, only if doctrinal disputes can be kept out of the political arena, only if political authority can be made neutral with regard to sectarian divisions, can there be domestic tranquility within Christendom. To this end, Locke proposed that government be reconceived and refounded on the basis of an imaginary social contract, that it be limited to the protection of the rights accorded human beings by nature, to the rights that no one in his right mind would think of alienating, first and foremost the right to life, liberty, and property, which is the formula that you'll find echoed in the Declarations of Rights that George Mason wrote for the Virginia Constitution, that John Adams penned for the Massachusetts Constitution, which is the formulation that Thomas Jefferson rephrased when he spoke of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in 1776 in the American Declaration of Independence. Now, let me pause for a second and say that change of wording does not exclude property, as has sometimes been argued, because if you go to the revisal of the laws of the state of Virginia written by the same Thomas Jefferson, life, liberty, and property shows up in the first clauses. So what's he doing with pursuit of happiness? It is not narrower than property, it's broader than property. What else does it include? Well, property is the chief way we pursue happiness in this world, and religious belief is the chief way we pursue happiness in the next world. And if you look at the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty, Thomas Jefferson argues that religious freedom is a natural right. Now, if you've listened to me so far, you might be saying, okay, why is it unsustainable? That's what Derek Webb back there in the corner, a lawyer, is thinking. What I want to know, is he getting married? He's a former student of mine. You worry about these people, especially him. Okay, let me go back to this question. To answer the question, let me rephrase it. What might you ask, why would anyone want any other arrangement than the one these men designed and we long possessed? To answer that question, I think we must look further back. We've had a quarter of a millennium of religious liberty. But prior to 1776, through nearly 4,000 years of the history of civilized peoples, there had been, as far as I know, no political regime that separated religion and politics. Whether in ancient Sumeria, Akkad, Babylon, Assyria, or Egypt, whether in the Hittite kingdom, Lydia, Persia, India, Southeast Asia, the Americas, completely unconnected with this, Greece, Etruria, or Rome, whether within the Jewish realms, the Kingdom of Israel, the Kingdom of Judah, within Christendom or the House of Islam, political regimes have always, until quite recently, looked to the gods, or to God, for guidance. One cannot, I think, chalk it up to culture. It transcends the diversity of cultures. It appears to be rooted in human nature. It is as if politics and religion are inseparable. Now, to answer the question I posed, we must also look forward, not back from 1776, but forward from 1776. For the era in which religion came to be relegated to the private sphere, something during that era, something else no less novel, emerged. I have in mind, first and foremost, the species of popularized philosophy that came in the late 18th century to be called ideology, and second, partisan politics grounded in quasi-philosophical ideological differences. Where there had been Arians and Trinitarians, where there had been Monophysites and Trinitarians, where there had been Guelphs and Ghibellines, where there had been Protestants and Catholics, where there had been Episcopalians, Presbyterians, and Congregationalists in all of their various forms, there came to be liberals, progressives, socialists, communists, fascists, and Nazis. And in a great many places, the liberal proponents of limited government lost out to those who favored totalitarianism. We had no totalitarianism before 1776. Totalitarianism emerges in the same world that the separation of church and state dominated. It was as if, when religion was relegated to the private sphere, what remained had an empty center craving content, and citizens fell prey to a powerful longing for a politics that would give meaning to their otherwise humdrum bourgeois lives. It is not, I think, an accident that each of the totalitarian regimes of the last century required of its adherents subscription to an elaborate creed. It is not an accident that they articulated in their defense a secular analog to salvation history. The communists even had, for God's sake, penance, self-criticism sessions, confession before the congregation. And in the most successful communist regime, which is the one in East Germany, they had all the sacraments secularized. To make sense of this, I suggest that we look back beyond Thomas Hobbes to Aristotle. Thomas Hobbes and his successors, most notable among them John Locke and the American founders, thought it possible to restrict the scope of politics to the realm of security, to the protection of life, liberty, and property, or to the protection of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They thought it possible to relegate religion to the private sphere, and they achieved, as I've pointed out, notable successes. In recognition of this fact, in 1835, after returning from France to France from his extended sojourn in the United States, this is a genuflection to the Tocqueville side of things, Tocqueville remarked, "When I compare the republics of Greece and of Rome with those in America, when I call to mind all the attempts that are made to judge the latter with the aid of the former and to foresee what will happen in our day, by considering what took place 2,000 years ago, I will fire Paul Ray as an ancient historian because it's worthless. I mean, I am tempted to burn my books in order to apply none but novel ideas to so novel a condition of society." He was not alone. Two decades before, Thomas Jefferson had observed, "So different was the style of society then and with those people from what it is now and with us, that I think little edification can be obtained from their writings on the subject of government. They had just ideas of the value of personal liberty, but none at all of the structure of government best calculated to preserve it. The introduction of this new principle of representative democracy has rendered useless almost everything written before on the structure of government, and in a great measure relieves our regret if the political writings of Aristotle or of any other ancient have been lost or are unfaithfully rendered or explained to us." I'm inclined to think that Jefferson and Tocqueville erred, that one cannot even begin to fully appreciate the novel character of the style and condition of society identified by these two figures, and to understand the challenges it came to face in the 20th century without immersing oneself in the books that the former thought anachronistic and the latter was tempted to burn. Above all, Aristotle's Ethics and Politics. If I am right, we need to reflect on the meaning of Aristotle's claim that man is by nature a political animal, and on the larger implications of this claim. For in this connection, Aristotle suggests that while the polis came into being for the sake of mere life, that makes him Hobbesian, sort of, it subsequently sustains itself for the sake of living nobly and well, and that's where he departs from Hobbes. In advancing this suggestion, Aristotle's not simply saying that human beings are gregarious. Such a claim would fail to distinguish mankind from the ants and the bees. He is contending that it's only in the polis that gregarious beings of our sort have a share in what he calls the good life. To understand what Aristotle means by the good life, we must take careful note of those faculties which distinguish man from the beasts. In Aristotle's view, human beings are set apart from the other animals not by their capacity for self-expression, but rather by their capacity for rational speech, logos. Man possesses more than mere voice, phoné. We have telephones from phoné. He can do more than just intimate that he feels pleasure or pain. In consequence, his humanity is in no way constituted by his ability to speak out. It's constituted by his ability to speak up, to get a load off his chest, to give vent to his spleen. He could just as well accomplish a purge of emotion by the inarticulate utterance of the beast. That's what speaking out is about. For Aristotle, logos is something more refined than the capacity to make private feelings public. It enables the human being to perform as no other animal can. It makes it possible for him to perceive and make clear to others through reasoned discourse the difference between what is advantageous and what is harmful, between what is just and what is unjust, and between what is good and what is anything but good. It is the sharing of these things, Aristotle insists, which constitutes the household and the polis, each as a community. Implicit in Aristotle's analysis of man's nature as a political animal is man's philosophical potential. If politics has its focus not just the preservation of life, as Hobbes, Locke, and so forth suggest, but also the pursuit of the good life, politics within a particular community must inevitably embody a conception of the good life. And given that the good life is a subject not only for deliberation, but also for dispute, different political regimes in different places will drift into conceiving of justice and the good life differently. Moreover, contests within a given political regime will often give rise to and turn on a debate concerning the perennial question, what is the good life? Or, how should we form our lives together in this polity? This will be especially true in a republic or mixed monarchy where public deliberation is the norm, where there is a space for the practice of logos, reasoned speech. The best regime, as Aristotle imagined it, is devoted to the development of intellectual as well as moral virtue. Religion looms large in Plato's discussion of politics, both in his Republic and in his Laws. On this subject, however, Aristotle has next to nothing to say. We must nonetheless go beyond what Aristotle makes explicit and emphasize religion's central importance. We must emphasize what he is hiding as well as what he's revealing. For as he certainly knew, human beings have always in practice looked to the divine for guidance when they have pondered what it means to live nobly and well. Theocracy may be exceptionally rare, as my former Oxford tutorial partner, Peter Simpson, is he here? With whom I had breakfast this morning, insists. But what he rightly calls theonomic regimes have been the norm through human history. And when human beings in a given polity have given thought in public or private to the good life, they have nearly always looked to nomoi, laws and customs, thought to be sanctioned by God or the gods. That's what theonomic means. Man's philosophical potential has rarely at the level of the individual and never at the political level been realized. There has never been a philosophical political community. For within the public sphere, philosophy has almost never been accorded authority. And when and where it has been accorded authority, as in the United States, if you think about the Declaration of Independence, philosophy has been reduced to a vulgarized doctrine, eventuating in a set of slogans. It is religion that's always been primary. The desire, innate within human beings, to live nobly and well, and to live as a community nobly and well, makes man a religious as well as a political animal. One might even say that to be a political animal is to be a religious, or in special cases, a philosophical animal. the impulse that sustains the political community cannot be fully satisfied within a system of governance that is indifferent to the question what it means to live nobly and well. When Aristotle speaks of the polis, he traces its genesis, as does Hobbes, to man's need for security. It comes into being for mere life. And he implies that the desire to live nobly and well awakens only after the city's establishment. You're interested in living nobly and well once you're secure. But when you're not secure, you don't think a whole lot about it. When he speaks of deliberation, he tells us that it has to do with the advantageous. Then he adds, and therefore, with the just and the good. How many of you have children? One of the astonishing things about young children is very early in their lives, your child will say to you, when you have children, that's not fair. And when they say that's not fair, what they mean is they're not getting what they want, and they've got an argument to present to you. They are already political at that moment. They are already dressing up their advantage in an appeal to higher norms. The order of the argument is important. Security and material advantage form the sine qua non of politics. It is only when they have been in some measure secured that the more generous impulse comes into play. And though these impulses are the source of a man's dignity, they can be very dangerous. For it is far easier to reach a compromise in disputes over advantage by splitting the difference, which businessmen do every day, than it is in disputes over question of high principle. What do we do about abortion? Do we cut the baby in half? Solomon proposed it once. Discussions of what it means to live nobly and well, and of what constitutes the good life, frequently give rise to bitter disputes, above all when religion comes into play. It's no accident that Aristotle does not treat piety as a virtue in his Nicomachean Ethics, nor is it fortuitous that he is virtually silent about religion in his Politics. In antiquity, as Numa Denis Fustel de Coulanges, in a book called The Ancient City, demonstrated in detail more than 150 years ago, the political order was a religious order. The two were inseparable. The gods were the city's gods, and the city belonged to those gods. In consequence, impiety and treason were indistinguishable, and cities such as Sparta, which were intensely pious, were for that very reason xenophobic in the extreme. Aristotle abstracts from all of this for reasons akin to those that moved Locke, Smith, Madison, and Jefferson to relegate religion to the private sphere. Internecine war was, he recognized, the bane of ancient Hellas. It was hard for the Greek cities to cooperate. More Greeks fought on behalf of Xerxes' Persians than fought in defense of the freedom of Hellas. And it was their inability to unite that later opened Greece to the Macedonians. If these cities found it impossible to work together, it was because each and every one of them was in the grips of an intense particularity rooted in its devotion to the gods and heroes peculiar to the land it occupied. When Aristotle treats politics in a fashion that puts it at a distance from religion, when, for example, in describing the activities distinguishing the best regime, he focuses on music and on culture, more generally, almost to the exclusion of religion, he is not arguing for an elimination of the religious core that gives rise to civic solidarity. He knows this cannot be achieved. What he is trying to do is to tone religious particularism down, to reduce its intensity, to moderate its influence by providing the citizens with a source of unity that does not set them so resolutely against outsiders. The history of political orders deeply entangled with religion does not suggest that we ought to take security and material advantage for granted. And when we think about political order and security, and political order, security and material advantage have to come first, as they did for Aristotle. Another way, way of putting it is a polity that does not provide security is worthless. A polity that provides security but does not provide guidance in living nobly and well is not worthless. Read St. Augustine. He has much to say in defense of a polity that is focused on defending the peace. Sublime though it may be, of necessity, in politics, living nobly and well has to be an afterthought. But we can't help thinking that afterthought. Aristotle is right about that. Put simply, there's an almost insuperable case to be made for restricting the scope of politics and for separating church and state. But it is by no means certain that such an arrangement can be sustained. The nightmare that engulfed much of the world in the 20th century was not a passing aberration. We are back in the age where people are looking for meaning in politics, even in this country. The impulse that gave rise to the various species of totalitarianism that wreaked havoc in the last century remains with us, and it's even more dangerous than it was in the 20th century. Think of the power that technology has put in the hands of those who control the state. If the old Soviet Union had the computing power we now have and the capacity for surveillance that the Chinese are now pioneering, it would still be with us. That impulse towards totalitarianism can never be expunged. That's what Aristotle has to teach us. The urge to live nobly and well through politics will always be with us. Liberalism and bourgeois society more generally leave us profoundly unsatisfied, and we instinctively long for what Thomas Aquinas, that's my genuflection to the Dominicans, called the civitas perfecta. It is a great shame, but it is perfectly possible that the liberal era will be looked back on as a blip on the screen, as a noble but quixotic experiment. Unfortunately, the only civitas perfecta that we can ever hope for is the civitas Dei. Thank you.